Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is that Jupiter is big on surprises. The Juno spacecraft that has been exploring our solar system's largest planet is discovering some very interesting things. We now have a three-dimensional map of the planet's internal structure, and we can look at its north and south poles. And it turns out at each pole, there's a cyclone several thousand kilometers wide, and each of those cyclones is encircled by this polygonal, I don't even know how to say that, but I've read that lots of times. polygonal arrangement of similarly sized storms. There are eight in the north and five in the south. So it's basically this perfect geometrical layout that no one can explain. And below its atmosphere, Jupiter is fluid, but the planet rotates like it's a solid mass. It's kind of like kids playing crack the whip with atoms of hydrogen and helium that are linking arms and spinning around the planet. And no one understands why this is happening, which is really cool. So if you might think, why the heck is a cool fact of the day on Bulletproof Radio about space? Because we are exploring space and it's awesome. And because if you haven't thought about that, honestly, in your lifetime, unless you're like really old and not very healthy, there's a pretty good chance that we're going to be putting people out there in our lifetime. And that's awesome. And I don't mean just on the moon. That's like the moon is for kids. Who needs that? All right. That came from Science News and was published in Nature. So we're just figuring out stuff we didn't know. And that's what this is all about. And speaking of stuff you didn't know,
what if there was a way to feel younger for longer? Well, there is. Your body needs something called the NAD plus molecule to help you age well. When you're young, your body makes a lot of NAD plus, and that helps you make energy. It helps you keep your DNA healthy, absorb nutrients well, and it protects your cells from stress. But once you hit about 30, your NAD plus levels start to drop. The good news is that longevity scientists have found some things that can help, like niacin, niacinamide, and niagen. They help your body make more NAD plus even as you age. All three of these are in an amazing formula called Qualia NAD plus. Check out Qualia NAD plus risk-free for up to 100 days at neurohacker.com/Dave15 to save an extra 15%. That's neurohacker.com/Dave15, Qualia NAD plus. It's what I use.
Today's podcast has very little, if anything, to do with space. It has to do with what's going on in your head and entrepreneurship. And it's with a guy who I've done a lot of work with, who's one of the world's foremost experts on entrepreneurship in action. Some of the world's top performing business owners have mentioned this guy as the person to go to teach how to be a better entrepreneur. And about 5 or so years ago, my good friend JJ Virgin said, Dave, you have to sign up and meet Dan Sullivan from Strategic Coach. And the reason she said this is that Dan has, for more than 40 years, been a speaker, consultant, strategic planner, and coach to entrepreneurs. And he's the only guy I've seen who basically created an operating system for entrepreneurs, especially entrepreneurs with ADD, which is essentially almost all entrepreneurs. And Dan, can I say how old you are?
Yeah, 70. I'll be 74 in 2 months that we're from our podcast right now.
So Dan's 74. And if you listen to the show, you might have noticed I love to learn from my elders, people who've made all of my mistakes for me ahead of time. The problem with Dan is he barely looks like he's my elder because he's on a pretty aggressive anti-aging regimen. And he is completely sharp and amazing and full of energy and has just helped so many people, including me, understand what's going on in our heads and in our companies. And Strategic Coach is based in Canada, up in Toronto, but now they've reached 18,000 entrepreneurs in 60 industries, and he's written 30 books. So if you want to know something about high performance, something about being an entrepreneur, or just what's going on inside your head, I don't know anyone better to talk to than Dan, which is why he's on the show. So, Dan, thanks for being on.
Yeah, well, Dave, when I think about meeting you, which was in a very, very hot Palm Desert, if I remember correctly, and you know, and I got very, very intrigued in how you approach the world, and you know, you have reputation through Bulletproof, and you know, now Bulletproof Labs, and all the product offerings that comes out, and I just see a perfect, terrific example of entrepreneurial capability multiplying itself in the world and reaching more people. So this is just a sheer pleasure for me because I'm in the presence of someone who does the one activity on the planet, one that I enjoy the most, but also I think that has the greatest impact on positive change in the world. And you will never know the people that you impact because the multiplication is happening too quickly for you to do that.
Well, thank you, Dan. Likewise, I suspect you don't know all the entrepreneurs who've been touched by your work and just all the employees. I'm a better entrepreneur because of the training. And you have this weird mind where you sort of step back or step out and see the system of what's happening in a company, mm-hmm. how decisions are made, and also how they're made in your head. And we're going to get into that. I want to know about your psychology. Mm-hmm. But first, we've got to just mention this. I think you're kind of a wuss because you only want to live to 156 years old, and I'm going to get to 180. So I got to say, like, step it up, man. But okay, here you are. I'm just kidding. But you're 73, and you are blatantly out there saying, I'm going to live to 156, and that's actually way more audacious than my goal because I'm a little younger than you are, but you are in supremely good health and you actually spend a substantial amount of time each day taking care of your hardware. You didn't always do that. Mm-hmm. So two things, how did you reach 156? And another thing is, like, when did you get into realizing that this mattered?
I have an activity and I've had it since I was a kid, which is called thinking about my thinking. So ever since I was a kid, I didn't need television because I could just sort of step back and kind of see how my brain was actually operating. And I'll just take you back to the year 1987. And I was just thinking about how people kind of talk themselves into the grave because they will say certain things. And if you talk to someone who's, you know, sort of in the process of retiring, about every fifth thing that they say predisposes their body to actually get off the planet as fast as possible. You know, like, well, I'm really slowing down now. And yeah, well, if I was younger, that's something I'd really be interested in. You know, I used to do this, but I don't do this anymore. And throughout the day, they're talking to themselves and they're saying about 50 things, which are telling their body, you know, not too much longer now, you know, you'll be out of here. And so I started watching this, and I'm adamantly opposed to entrepreneurs retiring, the whole notion of retirement, because I don't think, first of all, entrepreneurs don't have to retire because there's no mandatory age limitations on entrepreneurship. But the other thing is that I've noticed a lot of people retire right when they're at the top of their game. In other words, that, you know, that when they were 20, they say, someday I'm going to be this operating in this way. And they get there, let's say, 55 or 60. And they've never been smarter. They've never been more influential. They've never had greater freedom to really do what they want to do. And they say, OK, the game's over now. And I said, what a waste what a waste for them, but what a waste for a lot of other people around them. So I've developed this lifetime hatred of the notion of retirement, and that predated my doing anything. But in 87, I was just playing around, and people were starting to talk about the 21st century. You know, once you get over the halfway point in one century, they start talking a lot about the next century. And I said, you know, it'd really be neat to live from the first year of a century to the 100th year of a century. That would be a really neat experience. And I said, you know, I missed the 20th because I was born in 44. So I said, what I'll do is that I'll just use the next 56 years to get ready for the next 100 years. And that'll be 156 years. So Babs and I have agreed we're going to beam out in the year 2100, unless we change our minds, you know, late in the 21st century. But Dave, it's just a thought, and it was a silly thought that I kept to myself for about 6 years. But I noticed that after a while, I couldn't think of a normal age like, you know, 75 or 80 of dying. And my moment I thought about my lifespan, the number 156 came up, and it encouraged me to start really taking care of myself. It encouraged me to start thinking long in terms of entrepreneurial plans. So, you know, I'm 74 and I'm just starting the best program that we've ever created, which is called the Game Changer, in about 2 weeks. And I'm just committed that we're what we're going to do until I'm 99. So from 74 to 99. And that's a natural thought if you're thinking you're going to live to 156. That's like somebody, you know, who's 36 thinking that they're going to do the next 12 years until they're 50. So I'm finding that this 156 mindset and being with it for 31 years has enlarged my thinking about how much time I have and, you know, how I have to handle myself so that I've got energy and I've got focus. And three things, I've got three things that most people are running out of when they're in their 70s. One is they're running out of friends because they only knew peers and the peers are dropping off. They're running out of money because they don't have a way of producing money that keeps getting bigger. And number three, they don't have any purpose that took them beyond age 70. And so I stockpile friends, I stockpile money, and I stockpile purpose. And it keeps you excited about what you're doing.
I'm glad you mentioned purpose, because every time I sit down with you, you always have me break out a worksheet and talk about, you know, massive transformational purpose and talk about these really long-lived things. And you're one of the guys who inspired me to talk about this. I mean, I've been an anti-aging guy for 20 years running a nonprofit, and I've spent lots of time with people who are in their late 80s and 90s who just kick ass. And but it's one of the reasons I was like, okay, fine. Yes, I really do think 180 is a very achievable goal for me, unless a truck hits me or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's things like that. And also, I'm willing to die trying, because if I set my internal expectations, we all know that mindset matters so dramatically. For instance, you can only get smarter if you believe you can get smarter. And there's a study about that. I believe you can only live to whatever age you want to live to if you believe that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I believe that I've got to be thinking that way. And if you believe that you're going to get old and decrepit, you're much more likely to do it. So there's no cost to telling yourself you're going to live a very long time. Because if you're wrong, you're going to die anyway. And if you're right, your quality of life could go up. And what you found is that it's served as its own intrinsic motivator. But that alone wasn't enough, because you also have a big mission. And what is your mission, and how long have you had it?
You know, the mission has stages. And if you think about what you thought you were first doing when you introduced Bulletproof Coffee, there was that first stage of just getting it out there as something your friends tried and everything. But then it became a commercial venture and it was just about the coffee. And then it jumps to another level. So probably if you reverse engineered where you are today, and it's a worldwide philosophy now, Bulletproof is more than just about coffee. You've included a lot of other dimensions in it. Same thing happened in my business of strategic coach. And what I notice is that there's growth stages of entrepreneurship. And, you know, the most basic is that you're just self-employed, but you've essentially just created a job for yourself. You haven't really, you know, you don't have a company. And then you begin. So one of the decisive thinking tools that we've introduced in the program is very simple. It's called Who Not How, so that when you think of a dream, you know, a bigger and better result in the future, you don't think about how you're going to do that. You think, who is going to do this for me? And I say billionaires don't do how, billionaires do who. You know, if you look at billionaires, they have the ability to think big dreams, but then immediately their brains go to who. Well, that's a decisive difference, because you don't have to be the how person. You're just the who person. It does that. So my big one right now is called Game Changer. And you know, if I look at what you're doing in the world, you're changing a game on a lot of different levels. So I've got a room starting in a couple of weeks with 32 game changers who are taking their business and they're using it as almost like a asset in the marketplace to collaborate with another entrepreneur to create something that's 100 times bigger than either of them could get to on their own. But they're not buying each other out. It's not like it's a legal a new legal company. They're simply say we're going to produce a result that's 100 times bigger. You couldn't do it with your capabilities. I can't do it with my capabilities, but together we could. So this is the exciting next game for me. That's for the next 25 years until I'm 99, and then I'll see where I am at 99, what the next level is. And yeah, I kind of tested this with Peter Diamandis with Abundance 360, because he couldn't have created Abundance 360 and I couldn't have, but together we created it.
That's right. That's worth mentioning. Peter's been on the show a couple times and spoke at the Bulletproof Conference around this, more the technology side of what's going to happen. And you and Peter worked really closely on that. And this is also an event that I go to in addition to Strategic Coach. And a lot of people say, you know, Dave, how do you do all this stuff? And it's easy. You surround yourself with people who think at least as big as you. And like, that helps a lot.
Yeah, it does. And
the mistakes that I've made, and I tend to think really big, but the mistakes I've made have almost always been from not thinking big enough, even though I'm like, wow, I thought I was pretty good at thinking big. But when you have someone outside of you who doesn't have your perceived limitations, whether it's for how long you're going to live or what your company is going to do, there's something, and maybe it's like psychological or emotional or metaphysical, I don't know, but there's something that happens when you're in a room full of people who don't see boundaries that helps you to remove yours. But most of the entrepreneurs I've had the pleasure of coaching or just working with over the years as an advisor, a lot of them are stuck at that $1 million mark, and they're still, you know, washing their own socks and trying to do their own accounting. And especially I gave a talk to a room full of women entrepreneurs last year. And I was like, how many of you are still doing your own laundry? And like half the hands in the room go up. And I'm like, you have to stop. Like that is not how you build your company. Like, you have to have help and you have to get everything off your plate. And really the genesis for that was that the first time I sat down with you, Dan, you were so just insightful, because I think you've done this 18,000 times or something. And you said, all right, Dave, get out a sheet of paper and write down the percentage of time you spend on things that you just hate, the percentage of time you spend on things that are okay but you don't love, and the percentage of time on stuff that gives you energy. And I was like, wow, I'm spending a lot of time on stuff that I don't really like. And well, you're like, duh, that's what all entrepreneurs do. So let's see what you could do to get that stuff that you really don't like that sucks your energy. And when I did that, it was kind of a wake-up call for me to say, I actually need more help than I've allowed myself to have. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, I wake up happy and I have more energy to do the things that I'm good at. And so it's really driven me to build a really powerful team at Bulletproof. Yeah. You don't get to build a company of any scale, much less where Bulletproof is already gone and is going, without people who are much better at you and people who actually get energy from the things that suck your energy. And so you're the guy who taught me that. But I think somehow you learned that in your life.
Yeah.
How did you learn this early on? Like, who taught you, or did you stumble into it?
Yeah, I think that there was a real switch, because I don't think I'm I think I'm a natural thinker, and I think I'm probably kind of a natural psychologist, you know. And yeah. I grew up, my dad was an entrepreneur. He was a farmer first and then a landscaper. And but dad could never get beyond himself. You know, he just couldn't hire. And he was always doing everything himself. And I observed, you know, it really restricted his life, you know, and he had ambitions that he couldn't get to. Really, what I do is I get people to think about their thinking. I have an ability to think about my thinking. So I've created thinking tools like the one that you talked about that I did when I first met you. That's called the ABC model. A is everything that irritates the daylights out of you. B is things that are just okay. They don't irritate, but they don't motivate. and C, are activities that fascinate and motivate you and probably would for the rest of your life. And you gave a, if you kept increasing the amount of time that you could spend on the C activities, fascinating and motivating, you would energize yourself on a continual basis, but you would energize everybody around you. And really, the influence of an entrepreneur is really the amount that they energize increasing numbers of people around them. You know, it's really our impact on other people that's really makes us special entrepreneurs, you know, really special, special people.
There are a set of entrepreneurs who are all about the money, all about sort of taking.
Yeah.
Right. And they're usually people who are fearful or bullied or had a lot of trauma and haven't done their personal development work. My early entrepreneurial success, when I had a very different mission than I do now, it was like, how do we build the internet that's like so big? And like I played a very meaningful role in the early days of cloud computing and all. And it was like I woke up every morning, like I would dream about this, and it was like so important and world changing. And one day I'm like, that's kind of a solved problem. Like incremental change on this isn't exciting anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, this is my career. I'm going to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually Bulletproof sort of happened of its own thing. But the my mission has shifted really dramatically from back then to now. But when I was succeeding early on, it was like I was afraid of failure. So mm-hmm. you could run away from failure, but it sucks to do it and it sucks your energy to do it versus like doing something that's bigger than you. How do you identify the people who are working to do something bigger than people have a real mission? Or how do you mm-hmm. shift people who are like, I need the money into help them see that there's a bigger mission? Like, do you have a technique or a speech or something that you you use for that?
Yeah, well, I use a biblical phrase. You know, not everybody's familiar with the Bible, but the story of Moses getting the children of Israel, you know, out of Egypt. And I say, you know, the skills that get you out of Egypt aren't the ones that get you into the promised land. Okay, so there's two parts to an entrepreneur's life. And the first part is freedom from things that they don't really like, people they don't like, situations they don't like, activities they don't like. And I would say that 99% of entrepreneurs, their entire life is this freedom from things. And they're still having arguments when they're 60 about people who disrespected them when they were 15, you know. So it's this yeah. backward. They don't want to go back to the thing that they hated, but their whole life is getting away from the thing that I hated. And I says, probably we all do that. But there's a point where you have to shift from freedom from to freedom to. And, you know, if I use you as the model, the freedom to for you is just exploring all the ideas on everything that regenerates us health-wise so that we can go beyond what is the conventional notion of how long a lifetime is, because we're uniquely gifted in our generation that we're the first era and the first generation in human history where you can negotiate with how long you're going to live, you know, and that negotiation skill is going to be continually multiplied with science and technology, but the mindset to actually use that. So that's the freedom too for you. You're not getting away from anything anymore. You know, that's in the past. So what I notice is some people can't do that shift. It's hardwired into them, you know, that nobody's going to tell me what to do. You know, they have this attitude, I'm just going to do things the way I want to. You know, I got the money to do it, but it's all reactive. You didn't even create the stimulus for your motivation. The world did. It's a much greater gift to actually internally create your own stimulus about who you're going to be in the future. And people who are strictly reactive entrepreneurs give entrepreneurism a bad name over a period of time, whereas the person who is going towards freedom too is actually creating transformative capabilities for millions of people. So that's the shift that I see.
So if you came across a 24-year-old who's, you know, sort of running a internet scam, you know, we're gonna scrape some people and get them to buy, you know, whatever, so I can live on an island. And there's whole conferences for people who are sort of this mindset. What do you tell them?
Well, it's really interesting. I call them the paranoid. You know, they're really, really paranoid. I mean, I've met them and they're building bunkers, you know, in old missile silos. And, you know, they're equipping it with every kind of weapon. And, you know, when everything falls apart, you know, they're going to be the survivors. And then when everybody kills themselves, it's like Mad Max, the old movies, Mad Max, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like that. Now, and then they say they're going to create it in New Zealand and people won't even be able to sail there, you know, and everything else. And I said, you know, you're talking yourself into lunacy here. I says, you know, and the problem is they live in an echo chamber where they surrounded themselves with other people who are dystopian. You know, dystopian is the opposite of utopian. Utopian, everything's going to be beautiful in the future. Dystopian is everything's going to fall apart. But this is self-generated lunacy, you know. Actually, the world is incredibly more cooperative than it's ever been in history. More human beings are actually getting up in the morning and cooperating with each other and are being given the tools to cooperate. If you're a rugged individualist with great skills and you've been able to create an empire around you for kind of negative reactive reasons, you're not feeling the collaboration with other human beings. You're feeling competition. So the biggest shift I think we have to do is that the game has changed on the planet. And I think the internet is the massive change. And I think blockchain will be a million times more powerful than the internet, because really what the blockchain is exponential trust and collaboration. You know, when you take it to what it's really going to produce, it's kind of, we've already experienced this with the ATM systems over the last 25 years. You know, I've been using my ATM card now for 25 years and I've never been shortchanged, and the receipt is always correct. You know, it's always been the right amount of money. And but you think about the amount of trust and collaboration just to create that basic system. But it kind of is a doorway where all transactions are trusted transactions, and they're verifiable. So my feeling is a lot of people being very successful as entrepreneurs, but they're reactive entrepreneurs. They're not creative entrepreneurs. They're getting away from a past, but they're not creating a future.
I've seen that pattern in myself historically. And I do neurofeedback stuff with some very, very successful entrepreneurs, some of whom have been in your program as well. And yeah, it's really common. It's like I was bullied, or, you know, my parents mm-hmm. were mean to me, and it just leaves these old marks. And then you bring them into your company and your company becomes a reflection of, you know, someone who's reacting to whatever that bad experience was. But how do you, if someone comes into Strategic Coach, and I'm just, you're a source of wisdom for me. So like someone comes in and you recognize that they have reactive patterns. How do you teach them to see a reactive pattern?
First thing we do is get them to change their number when they're going to die. Okay.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. First hour of the program, I ask them, okay, write down the number, the age when you're going to die. And then we spend about 15, 20 minutes having them describe what they're going to be like the year before when they think they're going to die. And very strange, the year before, they're in great physical shape. They're mentally really sharp. They got a lot of finances, independent. They got great relationships and they've lived a wonderful life up until then. And everybody describes the year before they're going to die. And I say, so, okay, I'll repeat back what you said. So what do you think the chances are, unless you get hit by a truck, that you're going to die the next year? And they said they won't. And I said, okay, so how many more years beyond, let's say it was 85, how many years beyond 85? And they said, oh, 10 or 15 years. And I said, which, 10 or 15? And they said, well, 15. I said, okay, you've been with me for an hour and I just gave you 15 years more life, more life. And I have to tell you, the reason I'm telling you this, Dave, is that we do surveys of what is the most impactful concept in the program. It was the day they changed their number from what they originally thought to. And I said, now I've given you 15 extra years. When do you want to have them? Do you want them at the end or would you like them right now? I mean, there are 15 extra years. You can take them at the end, but just to make sure you get them, wouldn't you want to take them right now? So if you get the 15 extra years, you didn't weren't expecting the years. I just gave you 15 years. What would you do different with the 15 extra years? And all of a sudden they start changing their, I'd start spending more time with my friends. You know, I'd start, you know, I'd work out a lot more and everything else. And it starts a progression of changes. And they start taking these changes. It's all because they changed their number. You know, and that's where I became convinced of this, that the lifespan is mindset. You know, I mean, and I think that was true. Here's something, you know, it's a factoid you can get. But you had George Washington as the first president. Then you had the next four. And the next four were Adams, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. Jefferson and Adams and Monroe all died on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. They died 50 years after, so it was July 4th, 1826, the Declaration was 1776, and Madison died 6 days before. He didn't make it to the 4th. And they were all in their 80s and 90s, and this was in the early 18th century when average lifespan was, you know, 30. Maybe 30, 35, or 40. So you convinced me that they were surrounded by all the diseases and all the ways of dying. These men, why did they? And my feeling is they had a mindset they wanted to see the 50th anniversary of the founding of the country. And that's all mindset. And whatever they did to get themselves that 50 years, it was strictly the mindset that got them there. And it, for the most part, subsequent presidents have not lived as long.
Now, so you're giving people permission to live longer, which then changes their mindset.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we're talking about this because you're one of the more radical anti-aging people who's just willing to say, I'm going to live longer than I'm supposed to. But people say, well, isn't the world going to be too crowded? And my just understanding of us from a subcellular level on up is that we're wired to be nice to each other and to be kind, supportive, to support each other, to build communities. But we don't do that if we think we're going to die, because fear of death is the number one thing our body will respond to right now. If a tiger eats you, it's game over. So you respond to that. And if fear, even if it's fear of death, it still creates reactive behaviors. You get reactive entrepreneurs, you get reactive people. And then you get this fear of starvation. So, okay, we know that we're not going to starve in a modern world, but our body still gets cellular impacts like that. And then the whole, do you have love in your life? Because if the species doesn't reproduce, that's kind of a big thing. So if you can get those three things met, what's next? Bacteria form biofilms. They form yogurt and kombucha. And so if you assume that that wiring flows up into the way we are, we're at this point in time where it's easier than it's ever been to support other people. And if you're going to be around for 100, 200 years, whatever it is, do you want to build a world full of like starving, angry people trying to get you with pitchforks? Mm-hmm. Or do you want to have a world full of people who are set up to be nice to each other and just build a great world? And I believe that longevity makes people think more and focus more on making the world a better place rather than on, you know, having more. But I could be wrong, but that's been my experience. It's my own life. And it sounds like with all the people you've gone through this process with, they start being a little bit more external focused, would you say?
Well, the interesting thing is that I'll need a really long study. So in terms of the impact of this idea, it goes back right now, it goes back to around 2000 or 1993. So it'll be 25 years. I'm right at the 25-year mark since I've been doing this. And it would take 50 years or 60 years to see if you're actually extending people's actual lifetime. I mean, you'd need a big study, but I can tell you I've extended their careers. I've got growing evidence that I'm extending their careers another 10, 15 years, and I'm extending them at the top of their game. They're at their all-time money making. They're at their all-time influence. So I'm seeing this. We're just doing a series of testimonial interviews with people who have been in the program 20 years or 25 years or longer. And we have about 40, 50 of them who are more than 20 years. So they've been here every quarter for 25 years. And the one thing is that never comes through. First of all, none of them are retired, and some of them are in their 60s and 70s now. And they say that they've, you know, they've done all the really interesting things. They have goals ahead of them. They keep working and getting better at what they're really, what we call unique ability inside. That's the thing that always fascinates and motivates you. They're involved in the community way more than they were 20, 25 years ago. And then a lot of them have families with children, grandchildren, and they're taking a lot of time and they're leading very happy lives. I mean, what comes across from these testimonials is they're very happy. And my feeling, you know, we could talk a little bit about this, but the mindset actually changes the chemicals that flow inside your body. You know, you think happy, happy chemicals flow. Think unhappy, unhappy chemicals flow. I think there's a direct relationship between mindset and what goes on inside your body.
I think that modern science, just our understanding of peptides and ligands and neuroreceptors, definitely reflects that. And I've been working on my newest book that's going to come out at the end of this year. And one of the core tenets there is that happy people are more successful, but financially successful people are not more happy. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's actually good data to support that. But bottom line is, if you can't figure out how to be happy, you're less likely to be successful. And a portion of your training for entrepreneurs is to teach them to like focus on the stuff that makes them happy. And it has a neurochemical effect, a biological effect, and some sort of sociological effect that is pretty tangible. All right, let's talk some more about chemistry. So tell me, since you're on this aggressive anti-aging program, what's your deal with food and exercise? Like, what do you do?
I have to tell you, it's been more recent history than it was before. I go to Canyon Ranch twice a year. Canyon Ranch was sort of the pioneer in the luxury spa business back in the 70s. And we just have a nice routine there that people tend to stay. So we've got this annual thing. I was looking at the records from 25 years ago. I just happened to look, they have a big couple files on me over this time. And I noticed my resting metabolism rate had dropped from, and part of that is that I'm 25 years older. I probably have less muscle, and muscle really indicates resting metabolism. And I had lost in the hundreds of calories that I was just naturally burning every day. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get up in the morning. I'm going to get those calories. I'm going to burn those calories right away. So I just started, and I do, you know, really intense interval training intense. You know, if you had to do one thing to get better in life, do intense interval training. You know?
Oh, yeah.
It's great for the body. It's great for the brain. It's one of the major offsets against any brain failure, dementia, and everything else. So what I did is I started, I'm going to get up, and before breakfast, I'm going to burn 700 calories.
Good God. That's a lot. Okay, how do you do that?
You know, I've got a heart monitor, and you got your average, you got your age, you got your weight, and there's calculators, and you just punch in the information, and it tells you how many calories you burn. And then there's an afterburn, so I meditate after I do it, but I'm still, you know, if I meditate for 20 minutes, my heart rate during that is still around 100. I'm still, you know, so I'm still aerobic even when I'm meditating, so it's a little bonus at the end. And so anyway, in the 300, I did in February of 17 to February of 18, I said, I'm just going to do this for a year. And out of 365 days, I did it all except 3 days. Okay.
Wow. And you're 74.
73. Yeah.
73, about to turn 74.
73. But so then I got there and I said, and all my tests, so I go to a program called Apex in Dallas with a guy named Jeff Gladden, who's a cardiologist, and I get top to bottom. I do HLI, human longevity, you know, everything.
I've done that too.
And every test indicator from the year before was better than it was the year before. And I dropped 15 pounds of fat, and I had exactly the same amount of muscle, which you don't want to be losing muscle, but I didn't lose any muscle. And I lost 15 pounds of fat. And I mean, think of butter, 15 pounds of butter, you know how much fat I lost. And everybody, first of all, everybody starts saying, Dan, you start getting applause, you start getting recognition, which is a positive cycle. I dropped 3 belt sizes, you know, during the year, you know, my, and everything. So this year I've said, well, let's go for 1,000 calories before breakfast. So for the last 31 days, I've averaged about 1,200 calories before breakfast. Wow, and and there's probably an upper limit because I got to do some work during the day. But, I'm very energized by it. I get out of bed and my body wants to do this. So I said, until the body starts saying, I'll take a day off. But the body hasn't once said, take a day off. I'm really liking this. And then I've thrown in weight training, a lot more weight training, because I'd like to get my muscle up a little bit. You know, and you don't really gain that much muscle after 70. I mean, it's not an easy thing to gain muscle after 70.
It's not that hard if you're on testosterone, though, right?
Yeah, I'm on peptides too. I'm doing peptides. You know,
I was going to ask you about that.
It was one of the great benefits from the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Russians had worked on a lot of really interesting stuff that we had no access to, and now we're getting access to.
So you also use bizarre Russian peptides. I do as well.
It's not on the label, but they are bizarre Russian peptides.
It's some kind of acrylic writing. But no, there's all sorts of things out there. And for people listening, you probably don't know what a peptide is, but if you look at an amino acid, things like cysteine or methionine or glutamine, all these things, those are letters. And then you compose those letters into words, which are peptides. These are short pieces of protein. It turns out peptides are how most of your body communicates with other parts of your body using chemicals, are these short, basically, words. And if you get a bunch of peptides together, it's a polypeptide. That's basically like a sentence. And then a whole protein, like a whey protein or collagen, is like a paragraph or a page in a book where you've got a whole bunch of these letters strung together in different ways. So it turns out if you can get the right peptides in the right order, this is based on science from around 1972, around the year I was born, when we first really discovered which peptides did what, and we're still figuring stuff out all the time. But it turns out the Russians have been doing this forever, and some of the East German things. So if you dig around in the far corners of the internet, there are literally thousands of peptides that may help you put on muscle or help you stay young and things like that. And the science isn't done yet, but if you're going to negotiate with death, if there's enough evidence that it's probably safe and large benefit, well, compare that to what happens if you don't do it, which is you die and your life sucks before you die. I'll take that gamble. And yeah. I think it's cool that you're doing that.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I mean, so I've been in the APEX program, which is Jeff Glatton, since the middle of the year before. So this was 16. And my feeling was, because I went on a really, blood test based, and he custom designed supplements. So I take about 93 supplements a day, morning and night. You know, I mean, I find that a little bit grueling, but it's for a good purpose. And then I started the peptides in early 17. And my feeling, my desire to do that exercise would not have happened if I wasn't doing the supplements and the peptides. Good things are happening inside my body that's encouraging me to exercise, and the exercise itself is encouraging me to do other things.
What about the VASPR?
Yeah, the VASPR has been great. So I'm into my fourth year of the VASPR. So this is a man by the name of Peter Wisowski, engineer, inventor, and he created exercise device that puts together interval training, compression. So your muscles get compressed, and then cold. So it's roughly about 43 degrees. And you put on what looked like blood pressure cuffs on your upper arms, upper legs, and you do 20 minutes. The moment you start the exercise, it gets flooded with cold water. So the cuffs are not filled with air. They're filled with cold water. And the moment you start exercising, you get a muscle burn as if you've been exercising intensely for an hour or two hours, and your brain is being fooled that there's muscle tear, and it starts flooding your system with growth hormone and testosterone and IGF-1 and other things. And the other thing is you get about an 8-hour high after you do it, which probably encourages you to do it. You know, I like the high, and I do it on workshop days, and because workshop days, I'm on my feet, happy to be fully alert for 8-9 hours, and I find that still at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm on my VASPR high. So I do this every other day. I do I have about a 30-minute weight training as part of my morning calorie burn. And then the next day I do Vasper for the 20, 30 minutes.
And this is something that we've incorporated at Bulletproof Labs in Santa Monica, something I've got at my Alpha Labs where I test all the stuff at my house. And it's one of those things you're probably going to want to go to a facility because they're not meant for consumers to buy. But you've decided, like, return on investment for your exercise time. If your body thinks you did a long cardio workout, but you got to do it in less time and you burn more calories and you got more growth hormone, I mean, I could spend all day every day exercising, but then I wouldn't do all the other stuff I'm here to do.
Yeah.
So the idea is, how do you spend less time doing it? I mean, you've been a very early adopter of this stuff. So you're doing that. I do about 150 pills a day. And I've been able to cut that back a little bit because I've started stacking things. I'm finally manufacturing the supplements that I've been taking individually. Mm-hmm. So I can just, I take these three pills instead of these 12 pills and things like that. But it's to the point where before I go on a trip, I have someone help me put all these pills in little baggies because it was going to take me, you know, 2 or 3 mm-hmm. hours to do it. And I really wanted to play with my kids instead of doing that. Do you have someone who helps you count your pills?
Yeah, Jeff Gladden prepackages them. So I have my AM and my PM in their little baggies. And, you know, I wouldn't do it on my own. I mean, it's just too much of a hassle. And I'm ADD like many people. And so I just wouldn't have to do it. I would tell you this, if we could go back to that early conversation you have. Babs and I, you know, first of all, I have to put out here that I am nothing except for my teamwork and partnership with, I'm just a smart drunk worried about the rent if I didn't marry the right person and go into partnership, because Babs is the center of my life, the love of my life. We've been together for 35 years.
And I got to pause you for a second there. So I know Dan and Babs, and he's actually, everything he's saying is totally true. Like you, every time I see you guys, you're always together. You're always madly in love and supportive of each other in the business. It's actually inspiring. You know, you're in your 70s and a lot of people don't have a relationship that strong. So you've done something in your operating system for your life where you guys have a really good mutual thing there. And everyone who knows you guys knows it too. So just for listeners, there's no positioning there. Dan's speaking the truth.
Yeah. And her birthday was when we were at Abundance 360 and you were there, and her birthday happened and we got her T-shirts, and the T-shirt said, no Babs, no coach. You know, there's no strategic coach. And, you know, and I tell people, you know, I had to have this partnership. I had to have this relationship. And, you know, we really sync with each other. We say, you know, it was true on the first day. I say, you know, we're still on a 35 year first date. You know, it feels like a 35 year first date. And, you know, there's not a time when she's away for 4 or 5 hours that she comes into the room that my heart doesn't take a jump. You know, I'm in Bab's presence again. So that was really big for me. And, you know, I should tell you, my parents were married for 58 years and they were only friends for the last 5. Out of 58 years. And that was tension up until then. And what it was for 53 years, my mom wanted to have a discussion with my father on how he needed to change. And he never wanted to have that discussion. So they didn't get to talk to each other for 53 years. And she gave it up at the 53 year mark. And they were the best of friends for the last 5 years. Now they could talk about everything else. And I said, you know, I'm not going to do that. I had a practice marriage before I had Babs, and I had to go through a lot of learning. I had to go through a lot of learning to do that. But and I consider myself lucky. I found the right person, you know, but I was looking for the right person too. I needed this person. And, you know, and that has an enormous amount to do with my health, because Babs was way into fitness health. She ran a really top of the line massage, you know, therapeutic massage and nutrition when I met her. And she would have like stuntmen and air crews and ballet dancers who would come to her, and they all got better. If you spend any time with Babs, you get better. And so that, you know, so I'm very, you know, I get up every morning. I said, I'm a lucky man.
So that's a part of your longevity strategy. And I know a lot of people who don't work with their spouses. In fact, I'll shock everyone. I mean, I love my wife, Lana, a lot. And in the very early days of Bulletproof, we had We had a brand new baby and a 2-year-old. And I said, you know, I think this little blog I started to write to the stuff that I should have known when I was 20 about like how to make my biology work that would have changed my life so dramatically. I'm like, maybe 5 people read it, but now like a lot of people are reading it. And I think this is a company and we're going to call it Bulletproof. And she's like, what? Like we have kids. Like you have a job with it. Like, no, don't do it. I'm like, no, I'm going to do it. I want you to help. And she said she'd help. And we reached this point where I asked her to do something that she'd already agreed to do. And she, I don't know, just didn't want to do it. And basically said, I'm not going to do it. And I just thought about it for a second. And this is before I'd met you, but I was already doing this. Like you know, I need support for this. And so I looked at her and I said, you know what, Lana, you're fired. And she was like, what? Like you can't fire me. I said, no, seriously, like for our relationship, like it's not going to make sense. Cause I need to be able to rely on you like anyone else. Like you're going to do what you said you were going to do without all this stuff. And so that actually was it was a turning point where Lana supports Bulletproof. Like we talk about it a lot and all that, but she isn't, you know, an employee and we write books together. But I had to create some boundaries there. And I know some couples work together really effectively and other couples, like they both are entrepreneurs or one is and one isn't. Yeah. How do you advise people to figure out, should you work with their spouse?
Well, I tell you, Dave, one thing has become more mysterious. I mean, a lot of things have become clearer and simpler to me as I've gotten older. But the thing that's gotten more mysterious to me as I've gotten older is other people's relationships. I have no insight. I have no insight whatsoever to why other people's relationships either work or don't work.
I mean, that can't be true, Dan. You've had 18,000 entrepreneurs come through.
Yeah.
Any entrepreneur who's going through a divorce or going through a rough patch in their marriage or in a new relationship, it affects their business. It affects like how they fill out all their papers at Strategic Coach. Like you must have seen patterns.
Well, the one thing that's been a great help has been the Colby Profile by Kathy Colby.
Yeah.
And a lot of marriage partners want their partner to be something other than what they are. Okay. And that creates enormous strains. You know, it's like my mom wanting my dad for 53 years to be something besides what he was. And then, you know, in her 70s, she woke up one morning and said, you know, all the prayers I'm saying and all the money I'm sending to foreign missions I mean, she was real Catholic. I grew up in a real Catholic family. And she said, she told me one day, she said, well, I've just given up, but, you know, he's not going to change. You know, and I tried to not break out laughing. And, and then about a month later, she called up and she said, I don't know what it is, but he didn't leave for work today. He just sat around and we just talked all day and we've never talked like that in our marriage. And she says, what do you think happened? I said, well, you wanted to talk about him changing. He just never wanted to have that discussion. But now that he's okay the way he is, he likes talking about it. So I think that it's respect, you know. I think it was Malcolm Gladwell wrote the book Blink, and he talks about a marriage counselor in it who could watch a video for about 3 minutes of a couple in counseling, and he could make a guarantee of whether they would get together. And the one thing that he said that no relationship will overcome is contempt. He says, if I pick up contempt on the part of one person towards the other or the two couples, he says, there's nothing that can overcome thing of contempt. And I think what happens in a lot of marriages, the person isn't the way you want them to be, the person, and then after a while you have an attitude of contempt towards them and you start looking elsewhere for what you're looking for, and that breaks it apart. So my attitude is that if you just allow people to be who they are, encourage them to be their best within who they are, love grows out of that. I mean, the two of us really like each other just for who we are, Dave. I mean, I think why we have a really good relationship. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about Dave that I think I ought to change. I think Dave will continually see areas where he can improve that makes him a better person. And if I have any insight into that, I'll share it if I'm asked. But everything like that. But how you are at any time, just how you are, I think is great, you know, and I'm totally supportive of it to the degree that I can encourage the growth. I mean, we have Bulletproof at our workshops. I mean, we replace awesome. the corporate coffee, you know, where the corporate coffee comes from, we replaced it with much more nutritious and much more beneficial bulletproof coffee. And we tell the story. We say, what's bulletproof? And then we tell the story. Because I think you've single-handedly taken a commodity and you've given it a philosophical and a scientifically supported transformational view of what this coffee can do for you.
And you're saying that that's like an example of just taking someone for what they do without trying to change it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so for someone who claims to not have much insight into relationships, I think that this last 5 minutes might have proven you wrong there, Dan.
You can see it in the political realm right now. Yeah. The polarization is because there's just utter contempt on both sides for the other side.
And contempt is a form of ill will. And what I learned in just with electrodes on my head and in Tibet with Buddhists and things like that is that anytime you're dealing with ill will, you're dealing with ego. It's your own ego. And if you're spending your energy on that, especially towards your partner, because they aren't changing, that's not a healthy place to be. And you've got to either deal with your own ego or decide maybe I'm in the wrong relationship. But to just sit there and be pissed off and angry and judgmental about it, it sucks your own life and it makes everything suck. So your hack for that was to basically say, you know, you can be whoever you want to be and I'm not going to try and change you.
Yeah. And not only that, zero in on the areas where the person is really good. Flowers respond to sunlight and fertilizer, you know, so, you know, and do that. And we run our, that's the basic unique ability concept that lies at the, you know, at the heart of coach, that people are really good in these activities and they're not good in the other activities. So design their career so that more and more they're just in the center where they're really good and then put them into teamwork where they have a certain capability and somebody else has teamwork. And I really think this is how the planet is going. It's unique ability teamwork. For a long time during the industrial age, we were more or less preparing people to be human machine parts.
Right.
You know, human machine parts. And that's the way, you know, for good or ill, you know, for good or bad or whatever, that was just a stage. But we're at a stage where we can actually create really super machines. We don't have to make humans into machines. And my feeling is let's make humans into great humans so that they can work with great machines.
I couldn't agree more. And I keep thinking back to what happens in a Petri dish. And, you know, there's stages of growth. You know, you don't have enough of the basic food medium and things like that. You get all sorts of bad stuff happening. And when the environment's right, you get massive cooperation. And it feels like the environment on the planet's changing, so we're going to have that cooperation.
Yeah.
You said something else in one of the coaching programs that I thought was pretty insightful. And you said, my definition of hell is reaching the end of your life and coming face to face with the person you might have been. What made you put that into the coaching program?
The basic thing is that, you know, where I talked about sort of the contempt where you won't recognize another person for who they are. The real hell is never accepting yourself for the person that you are, so that however good you are, it's like zero because that's not the person that you expect yourself to be. And it's that you have an ideal of yourself rather than appreciating the reality of yourself. Okay, so I'm good at certain things, like I'm a good conceptual person. I've got really good conceptual abilities. You know, and I'm a good conversationalist. I'm good at thinking up very interesting thought processes that other people can use. Okay, and to the degree that I can do those three other skills, I'm a good marketer. You know, I can attract people into the program. Outside of that, there's nothing good. You know, I mean, and what I've done, you know, and I think I'm getting happier as I get the years go by. And that is in the last year, I've just said, if it doesn't start with a conversation, I'm not there. Okay. So any work that you want me to be involved in, if it's not triggered by a conversation, I'm not going to be there because conversations are the way everything happens. And I've made more of a shift in being useful to myself and others since I was 73 than in the 73 years before that. I mean, I've been all my shifts over the last year. And so if you have sort of a self-hatred of yourself, you know, that other people praise you, but your own attitude toward yourself is that you don't like yourself. You don't need hell after this life if you've spent your life not liking yourself in this life.
You must come across people who come into your coaching program who are stuck in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you tell them to go to a therapist? I mean, like what do you tell them to do if you pick up that pattern? Because I've worked with people, and like I don't really want to look at what's going on inside my head because I'm pretty sure I'm an asshole and I'll just confirm that. So I'd rather not look. And like they're just not willing to go there. What do you say to the people who clearly have that pattern?
First of all, you have to check out some sources, like Daniel Amen was at Genius Network. Daniel says, you know, a lot of people are just mean people because they've got brain damage. And he says, so, you know, before you start talking psychology, let's get a look at what their brain is actually doing. And a lot of people have really bad brain because they're consuming the wrong food. You know, sugar is not good for your brain. Sugar is bad in two ways. It's not good for your brain, but it's cancer food. Cancer loves sugar. You know, so if you really want to encourage cancer to grow in your body, put out lots of food for it. Sugar is their favorite. So I would go after the physiological. First, I mean, you have to start with the physiological. They just got the wrong hormones flowing through their body. That's making life look, unpleasant for them. And the other thing is people who give you a hard time, it's because they're having a hard time.
It's true. And the effects of traumatic brain injury on just all human beings, it's weird. I mean, Daniel Amen absolutely changed my career like almost 20 years ago with his technology. He's been on the show a couple times. And he's a mutual friend of ours. And we've also had Mark Gordon on from USC, who was looking at PTSD and traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
And what I'm finding at 40 years of Zen, something like 90% of these high performance entrepreneurs who come through to get a brain upgrade, they have existing traumatic brain injury. And we can see it in the electrical patterns in the brain. And yeah, when I was two, I fell out of my crib. Like, it's dumb little stuff like that, but it changes things. And I took a titanium knee to the head a couple of years ago. And that's a long story that might involve Burning Man. And from a mutual friend of ours, actually, we won't say who. Yeah. And it was like literally, I couldn't play Go Fish for a little while. But then I was swearing way more than I normally do. And I sent a few kind of stupid, angry emails that when I look back on that after I did, you know, the brain healing stuff, I was like, wow, I can't believe I did that. But you just have no awareness of that. Mm-hmm. So it also can be chemically induced, like toxic mold did that to me many years ago. If your hardware is broken, it doesn't matter your willpower, your desire. It's just not there. But did you have a traumatic brain injury or just blood flow?
Well, it's kind of funny because I didn't actually have Daniel Amen when I was there. I went through with another set of specialists there. The one thing, the way I answered my questionnaire and the way I tested were miles apart because, you know, I've got really good teamwork and, you know, I've really made my life very orderly for someone who is, you know, really ADD. So I met Daniel at Genius Network, and he said, do you mind if I pull your brain scans up? So I said, sure, go ahead. And he said, I've heard you're really smart. He says, I don't know how you could be with such a shitty brain. And he said, look at this. He says, first of all, he says, it's like a darked out city. He said, I don't know how you're producing the ideas. He says, it's like, you know, it was like a thick fog. It was like smog. But he said, there's real brain damage here. And I was knocked out twice when I was 17 in the same football game. Knocked out in the first quarter, knocked out in the fourth. They put me back in, you know, in the fourth quarter. First play, I was out. Next week, I was back in, you know, because they didn't, and everything. But I grew up on a farm, you know, I took falls. I was a scrapper when I was a kid. I was probably in, you know, 20, 30 fights where your head hit the ground or it hit something. And so, you know, you just have a lot of damage. And it was all there on the scan, all the damage. And so I went on, I went to Gundry, you know, Dr. Gundry. Yep. And we
He's been got on the show the, too, right?
Yeah, we got rid of the sugar and everything. And a year later, it was like a lit up city. And And, you know, Daniel Amen said, gee, that's really terrific. You know, what if you see the difference between the two? But I'll tell you, you know, and then he put me on pharmaceuticals. So I took Adderall 7 years ago, and it's been great for me. No side effects whatsoever. But the big thing was I just noticed that up until I took Adderall, my whole life had been noise, and I didn't realize it because it was the first time anything was quiet. And it's been quiet for 7 years now. And I've really done my best work since I was 66, the last 7 years. And it really tells you, and my diet has just improved enormously. And now I'm, you know, doing the fitness focused that I was talking about before. But I think that, you know, when you come across people who are really negative and they're really image, I got a feeling more and more there's real brain damage there. And then they're, you know, their body is just putting through a lot of very unpleasant chemicals.
So starting with the hardware, you found some problems. And Adderall worked for you, and you were in your 60s when you discovered it.
66. I was 66. And, you know, I can remember the day because they gave it to me, and I didn't take it for 3 months because I didn't know if I wanted to or not.
Right.
And one day before a workshop, about 15 minutes, and it's a low dose. It's 5 mg. It's not really a big dose. And it didn't hit me right away. And I was just in the workshop, and Dave, it was like a bang. I mean, it was kind of funny. It was like bang, and everything went quiet and everything slowed down. And ever since then, I've followed the agenda of the workshop, and I'm alert. And but I said it's been night and day. And I was doing good work before that, but the work I've done since 66. And all that told me is if that one thing worked so dramatically, what other things are coming down the line that will have equally dramatic? And so that's why 156, living to 156, I said, you know, we're in the age of miracles, but you won't use them unless you got a purpose and a goal.
Very well said. I remember the first time I tried Adderall. I was getting my MBA at Wharton. I had just had my scan from Daniel Amen, and I was really struggling. I was like, maybe I'm dumber than all these people. Like, I feel like I know the material, but I'm just failing on my tests. And I could like draw a curve of what my score would do. And Daniel's people are like, Dave, you don't have any blood in the front of your brain when you try and concentrate. So I tried 5 milligrams of Adderall, and I was like, wow, this class is really easy. But then at the end of the day, I was like, no one can touch me. Like, it had a pretty bad effect on me. So even that's kind of considered a baby dose. Like, normally people take 20 milligrams.
You can't get lower than 5.
Yeah. I was breaking them into quarters, and I was like, I can't handle this. And I found modafinil, which was off-label, was a much more powerful drug.
Yeah.
Not just for ADD, but just for, like, energy and focus. It did other things.
Yeah.
But I do have some questions about the long-term effects of Adderall, but not at 5 milligrams for your kind of brain. It's such a low dose. And I have great concern just for people listening. Don't start taking Adderall in school, like as a performance study enhancer. Like, there are much better substances for that. And there is addiction, and you can jack up a young brain that way. So like see a doctor if you're going to do that. Like, don't buy it from your friends. That's not how it's meant to be used.
You know, everybody's got a unique chemistry, and I just happen to be lucky that something that was off the shelf, you know, actually worked. And, you know, and I say go to a clinic like the Amen Clinic and get yourself studied and get professional help. Don't think that you can self-diagnose and self-prescribe that you're going to nail the target. Anyway, one thing I wanted to ask you, and I just came across it for the first time about 4 weeks ago, and it's the managed use of very, very minute amounts of LSD to overcome PTSD. I mean, I got very interested, you know, in this because PTSD, it happens, we think about it as troops coming back from Iraq or anything, but PTSD is about trauma, and trauma can happen in many different areas of life. Yeah. And they're just talking about 80% success rate after 3 sessions, you know, and these have been controlled sessions over 15 or 20 years with hundreds of people. I think this is a fundamental breakthrough.
There's amazing stuff happening. And we deal with a lot of PTSD under neurofeedback scenarios, and a lot of the things like holotropic breathing, which we did at a recent conference. I've interviewed Stan Grof, the guy who created transpersonal psychology, the first guy to treat trauma with LSD in the 60s in the old Czechoslovakia before it split apart. And so microdosing of LSD is something that people do for cognitive enhancement, and you take about 5% of a normal dose. But when you're dealing with trauma, you go in with a licensed, trained therapist, and you take LSD at a full dose. It's not a microdose. It's a whole tab, which is about 100 micrograms. Or they're also using sometimes mushrooms, or they're using MDMA. And the FDA now has allowed MDMA trials. There's the most research on that. Yeah. I don't think anyone's going to see changes around PTSD from microdosing, but from using a full dose in the right set and setting where the intent is to do that with someone who knows how to walk you through the steps. I've seen it transform people's lives. And you can go back to very early traumas. Like, one of the most traumatic things that ever happens to you is being born. Like, you're like, I'm in this warm, floaty place and someone smashes me and they kick me out. There's this air and light. And like, I had a lot of birth trauma that really made me some of the human being I was. I was, you know, you come into the world, your body is programmed for fight or flight. I was choked by the cord when I was coming out, right? So I'm like, I don't know, someone's trying to kill me and I'm just a baby. What the heck? But if you get that pattern, you'll be an entrepreneur and you know, someone does something that might potentially be a threat to your company and you're like, they're trying to kill me. And then you get super reactive and you make terrible business decisions and you act like a jerk and you don't even know why, because it's all subconscious. So I think to be an awesome entrepreneur, you have to find your triggers. And I don't know any human who doesn't have some things that are trauma triggers. Sometimes it's not full on PTSD, but I actually recommend, like, if you're not going to go do something like that, you can do ayahuasca, like I did in Peru. You can do holotropic breathing, do a 10-day Vipassana. There's a whole bunch of ways, EMDR. Yeah. But everyone listening, you got to do it. And if you want to perform at the highest levels in your life, there's probably 20% of your energy is going towards reactivity to patterns that are not conscious that were set by old trauma.
And they're not accessible through counseling, just normal counseling either.
By design, they happen first before you can talk about them.
Yeah.
And when you use a substance like that to get in there, and I mean, I was at this dinner, Dan, in New York, 25 of like extremely powerful people in New York, you know, hedge fund managers, just kind of a who's who dinner. And I didn't know what to expect. I just kind of showed up and was like, wow, there's some serious people here. And we did a Jeffersonian dialogue, which is where only one person at the table talks and sort of says what they wanted to. And then only one person talks at a time. This long table is really neat because we actually had the most fascinating conversation. And it was my turn. I'm like, how many people here have used a hallucinogenic substance for personal development or performance enhancement? Okay. There's people from 25 to probably 75 in the room. Every single hand went up. Right, all age groups, all this, and you know, some of these people were billionaires, and you're like, okay, you know, and we had a great like hour long discussion about it. So I think there's enormous power in this, but there's also enormous risk.
Yeah,
you know, there's kids going off and doing it in Disneyland. Like, these aren't recreational substances; they can mess you up. But under the right conditions, you got to do something to get inside your head. And so, I mean, if that's something you're considering, Dan, we can chat about it offline. But
no, but this is you know, I was just. Intrigued with it because I've done a lot of work with veterans and they just don't get over it. You know, you know, there's lots of things that help or to kind of take the pain away a little bit, but it doesn't really solve the issue. And, you know, my mother said I was the happiest baby she ever encountered in life. So I think I got a good deal coming out. Anyway, Dave, what a pleasure. We've talked about this for a long time, but this is just been a total pleasure.
It has. And Dan, I have one more question for you and then we're done. Someone came to you tomorrow and said, I want to perform better as a human being. It's better at everything I do. What are the three most important pieces of advice you'd have for me? What would you offer them?
Yeah, well, the first thing that, I mean, because it's worked so often, I get them to check out the number when they think they're going to die, because it'll immediately reframe what they think about the future. And nobody's happy with the first number they come up with. They always expand it onward. And then the second thing is, I would very, very seriously go and get your brain checked up and get a scan on your brain, because if you're really successful, you may be doing it in spite of brain damage. And if you correct the brain damage, not only will you improve your performance, but you'll be performing for the right reason. You won't be responding to some sort of trauma in the back where it's freedom from rather than freedom to. you know, a lot of entrepreneurs are incredibly successful, but they're buying freedom away from a really nasty past, and their whole reference is the nasty past that they had. But they're not actually performing to create a better future for themselves that they can share with other people. That's the second thing. And the other thing is that they focus their entire future on who, not how. In other words, that when they have a really big goal, they don't think, how am I going to do that? They think, now, who can I find that's actually going to do that in teamwork with me? And I'll provide the what and why, and they'll provide the how. And those are the three that I would go for, because they have to get a different view towards their life. They have to make sure that they got the right operating equipment with their brain. And the other thing is, they have to stop being the doer, and they have to start being the inspirer of other people.
What a profound answer, Dan. Thank you. For people listening, if you like this episode, you should check out Dan's 30 books and all. He runs strategiccoach.com. And just a fascinating human being who's helped a lot of friends, helped me grow our companies and just make better lives while doing it. So Dan, thanks for all your work. Thanks for being on the show. Any final URLs or something I should mention I didn't already mention?
Yeah, the one thing it had to do with the Jeffersonian conversation that you had. I've studied Jefferson, and Jefferson strikes me as not a very happy human being. And brilliant man. And it's the line in the Declaration of Independence, which is for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I'm completely in agreement with life and liberty. But I think that the pursuit of happiness means that you're never going to be happy because you're pursuing happiness. And my sense is America 2.0, it should be life, liberty, and the expansion of happiness. Start with the happiness you have and keep expanding it outward, and including more people in your happiness. And I think that will produce a better America in the future rather than pursuing happiness.
Well, what an amazing spin on that. What an amazing interview, Dan. Thanks.
Thank you. Love it.
If you liked today's episode, you know what to do. Go to Strategic Coach and check out Dan's work, or go to bulletproof.com/iTunes and leave a review that said this was worth your time, because when you leave a review, it helps other people on iTunes find this, and it's a great way of expressing gratitude, and gratitude is the most impactful and free biohack of all. Thank you.
A Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.